If Fox Connor in his dank quarters in Panama had given Eisenhower a graduate seminar in strategy, the 1930s would immerse this talented but unfulfilled officer, now nearing 40 years old, he'd been a major for 10 years, in another kind of learning, the bureaucratic and institutional politics of Washington, D.C. In the fall of 1929, Eisenhower was assigned as an aide to Brigadier General George Van Horn Moseley, then serving as executive assistant to Frederick Payne, Assistant Secretary of War. After a delightful but marginal assignment in France, Eisenhower was able to observe and participate in the making of national defense policy. "Except for the fact that I do not like to live in a city," he confided to his diary, "I am particularly pleased with this detail. The general is alert and energetic and certainly enjoys a fine reputation for accomplishment in the army. I'm also looking forward to the opportunity of learning something about the economic and industrial conditions that will prevail in this country in the event of a major war." For 2 years, Ike studied the problems of industrial mobilization in wartime, the start of a lifelong concern with the problem of America's military preparedness. In the late 1920s, the U.S. Army was in dreadful shape, with barely 120,000 men. By comparison, Eisenhower would have 3 million men under his command in Europe at the close of World War II. Congress had slashed the Army's budget, and as a consequence, the links between industry and the military procurement process had withered. All this would have to be restarted from scratch in the event of war. Ike labored valiantly in studying America's industrial capabilities and the need for close government-industry cooperation in wartime. After months of inspection, tours of factories, workshops, and rubber plantations, Eisenhower declared in a journal article published under the name of the Assistant Secretary that the most important lesson of the First World War was this: "When great nations resort to armed conflict today, the readiness of each to meet promptly the needs of its armed forces and munitions, and of its civilian population in the necessities of life, may well prove to be a decisive factor in the contest." As early as 1930, he grasped the need for modern states to build a standing military-industrial complex. Eisenhower had a way of being noticed by senior officers, and by 1931, the new chief of staff of the U.S. Army, General Douglas MacArthur, had come to see in Major Eisenhower a valuable talent. MacArthur was America's leading soldier. He'd had a legendary career at West Point, graduating first in his class in 1903. Fighting on the Western Front in World War I, he rose to the rank of Brigadier General, won the Distinguished Service Cross twice, and earned the Silver Star for Valor in Action 7 times. He had served as superintendent of West Point, did a tour of duty in the Philippines, and in 1930, though the youngest major general in the Army, became chief of staff. MacArthur was an impressive figure, but he was also egotistic, vainglorious, and somewhat operatic, besotted with his own self-made legend and sensitive to the least slight. Eisenhower found him forceful and blessed with a fast and facile mind, but he disdained MacArthur's obsession with politics. Most officers tried hard to respect the line drawn by tradition between politics and the military, while MacArthur chose to ignore it. As a result, Eisenhower's duties under the chief of staff began to verge on the political, even to the edge of partisan politics. Over time, close association with MacArthur provided Eisenhower with a role model of the kind of military leader he did not want to be. In 1931, MacArthur gave Eisenhower the job of writing the Army's annual report, then rewarded him with a commendation for his work and roped him into his entourage. Ike was now ensconced in the higher reaches of the military, but he paid a price for his proximity to the ostentatious chief of staff. In the summer of 1932, MacArthur brazenly led the army into the streets of southeast Washington to evict 20,000 destitute war veterans who were demanding payment of back wages for their war service. Eisenhower counseled him against using army troops as policemen. "By this time," he recalled, "our relationship was fairly close enough that I felt free to object. I told him that the matter could easily become a riot, and I thought it highly inappropriate for the chief of staff of the army to become involved. MacArthur ignored this wise advice and ordered Eisenhower to don his uniform, mount up, and ride along with him to conduct the operation. MacArthur's assault on the Bonus Army led to disaster. Ignoring orders from the Secretary of War not to provoke a larger confrontation by crossing the bridge over the Anacostia River, MacArthur led his cavalry forces directly into the encampments. Federal troops were thus turned on the former military men in the streets of the nation's capital, and the huts of the protesters were set ablaze. The event haunted Eisenhower for years, and though he obediently wrote MacArthur's official report of the incident, he privately railed against the chief's lack of restraint. The whole scene was pitiful, he felt. Eisenhower's value to the chief of staff was so great that he was given increasingly large tasks to perform, as MacArthur lobbied Congress heavily for increased army budgets. It was hard going, and 4 years of intense work in the War Department took a terrible toll on Eisenhower's health. Severe back problems and attacks of abdominal pain, the start of a long affliction that would finally be diagnosed as ileitis, left him exhausted. But with Eisenhower helping him, MacArthur got results, and the fate of the armed services slightly improved under his leadership. After an unprecedented 5 years as chief of staff, MacArthur received orders in 1935 to go to the Philippines to create a new army for the soon-to-be independent nation. He had no doubt which officer he wanted to serve as his military advisor. Eisenhower endured a difficult 4-year tour in the Philippines under MacArthur. The task he had been set, to plan for the construction of a Philippine army and the defense of the islands, was almost impossible, since the Philippine government had no money to pay for such a force, nor did it have any sort of military tradition or infrastructure from which to begin. Eisenhower had to devise a 10-year plan for training an officer corps, building up a reserve, equipping this armed force with everything from uniforms and rifles to aircraft, designing a network of training facilities, and putting together a curriculum for officers, all without the needed funds. MacArthur left the work to Eisenhower while he basked in the adulation that came to a man of high rank. He managed to appoint himself field marshal of the non-existent Philippine Army. MacArthur loved the stage, and Eisenhower, on a 15-man staff, was obliged to serve as audience while the general fulminated about President Roosevelt or bored his subalterns with soliloquies about his West Point days. MacArthur may have been America's most distinguished soldier in these years, but his patronage did Eisenhower little good as long as he was stuck in the Pacific, without a combat command, drafting plans for a phony army that would never see the light of day. "The sooner I get out of here, the better I'll like it," he privately wrote. World events would soon reshape Eisenhower's career path. In early September 1939, sitting in a friend's living room in Manila, Eisenhower heard a crackling, barely audible radio broadcast from London, carrying an astonishing message from Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. In a voice that was stricken with defeat and sorrow, Chamberlain declared that all his peacemaking overtures to Hitler had failed. His country was at war with Germany. Though a tragedy for the world loomed, Eisenhower must secretly have rejoiced. "I hoped a field command awaited me," he admitted. "The task ahead was one for which all my life I had been preparing." 5. When war broke out in Europe in September 1939, Eisenhower was a 49-year-old lieutenant colonel stuck in a distant outpost in the Pacific. Less than 3 years later, in June 1942, General Eisenhower took command of the entire European theater of operations in the war with Germany. Some contemporaries expressed wonder and sheer bafflement at this meteoric rise to fame and power by the once obscure staff officer who had never commanded troops in the field. Yet inside the armed forces and in Washington, D.C., Eisenhower had developed a reputation for planning brilliance, hard work, supreme organizational skills, and personal qualities of tact, loyalty, devotion to duty, and optimism. Eisenhower himself said it best. He had been preparing all his life for this moment, and he would make the most of it. First, he had to get out of the Philippines as fast as possible. He begged MacArthur to let him transfer to a combat command, and MacArthur, perhaps now seeing an Eisenhower arrival, seemed glad to be rid of him. Pulling strings with friends in the States, Ike secured an appointment to the 15th Infantry Regiment at Fort Lewis in Washington State. He kept moving up, first to Chief of Staff of the 3rd Division at Fort Lewis, and in March 1941 to Chief of Staff to the 9th Corps. With that post came a promotion to Colonel, but he had no time to rest on his laurels. In June, he became the 3rd Army's Chief of Staff with orders to relocate to San Antonio. With war in Asia and Europe brewing, the U.S. Army at last roused itself from its long interwar slumber and began to knock off the rust of two decades. Congress, which in September 1940 had passed legislation creating the country's first peacetime draft, reluctantly extended the law in August 1941. Millions of young men were now registering for what would soon become a huge expansion of the armed forces. As 3rd Army Chief of Staff, Eisenhower had to prepare these raw recruits for real fighting. In the late summer of 1941, he staged a military exercise in the swampy Louisiana backwoods, a war game that involved 500,000 men and 19 divisions in a mock clash between two armies, spread out over 3,400 square miles. Eisenhower's staff work helped lead to a smashing victory by his 3rd Army forces, and it also got him his first star. He was promoted to Brigadier General on October 3, 1941. Powerful figures in Washington took note. Certainly the new Army Chief of Staff, General George C. Marshall, noticed. Marshall, the man identified by Fox Connor a decade earlier as the Army's finest officer, had begun to assemble the brightest minds he could find to staff the War Plans Division in Washington. Just days after the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, Marshall ordered Eisenhower to report for duty in the nation's capital. After a brief stint as the deputy of war plans under his friend Brigadier General Leonard G. Giroux, Eisenhower took the helm as chief of the War Plans Division in February 1942. The appointment was reported by the New York Times, the first time Eisenhower had his picture in that paper. Once again, Eisenhower had been snatched up by a powerful patron, first O'Connor, then Pershing, MacArthur, and now Marshall, who needed his competence, his hard work, and above all his confidence in making large decisions. Marshall placed enormous trust in Eisenhower, and Ike always honored him for it. "I must have assistants who will solve their own problems," Marshall told him, "and tell me later what they have done." The historian of Eisenhower's presidency can draw a direct line between these words and Eisenhower's own management style as chief executive, when he too would look for powerful and confident lieutenants and allow them the freedom to run their own departments. Marshall and Eisenhower made a dynamic team, among the best general officers the U.S. Army ever produced. The two men collaborated in developing America's grand strategy for the war. The United States faced the awful dilemma of choosing between fighting Japan or Germany, for it could not engage both fully right away. With MacArthur pinned down by the Japanese invasion of the Philippines and desperately short of everything, the temptation to try to rescue the American and European position in the Pacific was powerful. But Marshall's new chief of war plans saw the larger picture. "We've got to go to Europe to fight, and we've got to quit wasting resources all over the world, and still worse, wasting time," Eisenhower confided to his diary. "If we're to keep Russia in, save the Middle East, India, and Burma, we've got to begin slugging with air at West Europe, to be followed by a land attack as soon as possible." President Franklin Roosevelt and Prime Minister Winston Churchill, meeting in Washington for 3 weeks from December 22, 1941, to January 14, 1942, reached the same conclusion. But translating this broad idea into operations would prove immensely complex. To speed things up, Eisenhower had his War Plans Office flesh out the Germany First plan. The first stage would be a massive buildup of U.S. forces in Britain, codenamed Valero, followed by a cross-channel invasion of France. General Marshall tried to sell the plan to the British, who were apprehensive about rushing into the continent too quickly with too few resources. As Anglo-American strategic conferences fought over the precise timetable and direction of the cross-channel attack, Eisenhower sketched out the creation of a European theater of operations, supervised by a London-based Allied headquarters. In June, after showing Marshall the plans he had devised, the chief of staff assigned Ike the biggest American job of the war. He was to become commander of the entire Allied war effort against Hitler. On June 24, 1942, Major General Eisenhower arrived in London and assumed command of the Allied war in Europe. He started his tour of duty in typical Eisenhower fashion. As the New York Times Riley noted, he talked informally off the record with British and American correspondents, giving an excellent demonstration of the art of being jovially outspoken without saying much of anything. 6. Eisenhower's 3 years in command of the Allied armies in Europe featured an almost unimaginable series of crises, decisions, conflicts of personality, disappointments, and setbacks. It was perseverance and exhausting effort, and the heroic sacrifice of millions of soldiers from dozens of nations, Eisenhower led the Allied forces to victory over Germany. These were years that could have broken any man. They certainly took a terrible toll on Eisenhower's health. Yet he came through the ordeal as a revered, universally acclaimed military leader, a man recognized for his decisiveness, tact, unfailing goodwill, penetrating intelligence, and absolute commitment to victory. In preparing him for a future career as a political leader and commander-in-chief of the United States, the war years steeled him as no other experience could have done. As the military leader of a multinational alliance, Eisenhower faced a preeminently political task, to fuse together the British and American military establishments with their wholly contrasting traditions, organizations, and operational doctrines into an effective fighting force. Such an amalgamation proved enormously difficult, for, as historian Max Hastings has recently shown, American opinion toward the British in mid-1942 was low indeed. The Americans thought the British were shy of fighting after their licking at Dunkirk in May 1940, and British reluctance to open up a second front in France sustained this opinion. One English visitor in America declared that anti-British feeling was beyond belief, especially among senior army officers. Eisenhower had to reverse this tide. Quickly. Upon his arrival in London, he set the tone in terms that would come to mark the Eisenhower style. In his first day on the job, he demanded that an atmosphere of the utmost earnestness, coupled with determined enthusiasm and optimism, characterize every member of this staff, that pessimism and defeatism not be tolerated, and that any person who could not rise above the recognized obstacles and bitter prospects that lie in store for us has no recourse but to ask for instant release from this theater. The British High Command placed the first obstacles in Eisenhower's path. Churchill had very definite ideas about how the war should be run. He wanted to attack the soft underbelly of the enemy in the Mediterranean, North Africa, and Italy. Eisenhower and Marshall strongly opposed this plan, which they considered a diversion of men and resources into a theater with little real strategic significance. Victory must come by slaying the German dragon in its lair, namely, Germany. But Churchill and his military commanders, especially the chief of the Imperial General Staff, General, later Field Marshal Alan Brooke, would not relent. In any case, it had become clear that Eisenhower's favored alternative, an immediate cross-channel attack in France, would not be ready in 1942. Roosevelt ordered his generals to stand down. The Americans had to get into the fight somewhere, and in 1942 it would be in North Africa. Eisenhower now had to lead Operation Torch, the invasion of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, a plan against which he had vociferously fought. All this was unknown to the wider world, of course. Publicly, Eisenhower cultivated the image of a sturdy American fighting man, all business and little fun. The press played up these traits. A profile of the general on the eve of the North African campaign described him as tall and lean, with hard muscles around his jaws and lips that can straighten into an Archimedean line, blue eyes that glint like marbles. He is tough as hell. The reporter wrote that the general was known informally as Ike, the nickname he'd had since childhood. He is the best liked and least social of any American officer in London. The town is full of stories about him, but hardly anyone outside military circles knows him. Early in his London tour, he ceased attending clubs and social events, seeing such frivolity as time-consuming and wasteful. He has established the 7-day week for his officers and eliminated any idea of the 8-hour working day. The press relished Eisenhower's public persona as a driven, tough, relentless military mastermind. It was hard to live up to the hype. The North African campaign, once underway in November 1942, did not go well. Within days of the landings in Morocco and Algeria, Eisenhower had to make a political judgment that nearly upended his career. By welcoming into the ranks of the Allies the collaborationist French leader Admiral François Darlan, who was in North Africa at the time of the invasion, Eisenhower seemed to be coddling the enemy and rewarding the treacherous behavior of Frenchmen who had made common cause with Hitler. Eisenhower's view was simple. Darlan's popularity in North Africa meant that the French army, which deeply resented the Anglo-American invasion of their empire, would come over to the Allies without further bloodshed, allowing Eisenhower to turn on the real enemy, the Germans, all the more swiftly. But at home and in Britain, Eisenhower's Darlan deal triggered a good deal of negative press. More important, Eisenhower's operational plan in North Africa was unduly cautious and slow, giving the Germans ample time to counter the invasion and reinforce Tunisia. Terrible weather, a thin supply line, inexperienced troops, and a chaotic command structure slowed progress. It would take 7 months of heavy fighting to gain control there, and the Germans made the green American soldiers pay dearly. The British generals sharpened their knives. According to General Brooke, Eisenhower was at a loss as to what to do, and allowed himself to be absorbed in the political situation at the expense of the tactical. In late December, Brooke huffed in his diary, "Eisenhower as a general is hopeless. He submerges himself in politics and neglects his military duties." Still, Eisenhower retained the confidence of the men who mattered. On January 23, 1943, General Marshall visited him in his headquarters in Algiers and reaffirmed his belief in Eisenhower's talents. Shocked by Eisenhower's harried, anxious appearance, Marshall instructed Eisenhower's naval aide, Captain Harry Butcher, to look after him. He is too valuable an officer to overwork himself. Surviving the political and military missteps of North Africa, Eisenhower was now saddled with another operation he opposed, the invasion of Italy. This, too, reflected British strategic interests, asserted at the Casablanca Conference in January 1943, and was another waste of precious resources. But once committed to it, Eisenhower toiled to make it work. The invasion of Sicily and the southern tip of the Italian peninsula during July through September 1943 featured many of the same mistakes made in North Africa. The Americans lacked daring, relied instead on a slow buildup of materiel before taking decisive action, and again the Germans escaped a decisive engagement. Eisenhower was not above self-criticism. In August 1943, with Sicily just about fully in Allied hands, he was still assessing previous operations and identifying mistakes. "The trouble with Ike," Butcher noted, "is that he has no harness for his brain cells. They keep poring over problems, both real and imaginary, as ants swarm over an anthill." By the end of 1943, Eisenhower's forces had been fighting in the European theater for over a year, but had yet to land a mortal blow on the German army. Even so, Eisenhower emerged as a popular public figure, in large part because of his excellent relations with the press and his candid, upbeat personality. He was the embodiment of Allied unity and optimism. His zeal in waging a war for freedom never waned, and the public could see the sincerity of his commitment. "In no other war in history," he wrote to his friend Sweet Hazlitt in a letter typical of his unfeigned devotion to the cause, "has the issue been so distinctly drawn between the forces of arbitrary oppression on the one side, and on the other, those conceptions of individual liberty, freedom, and dignity under which we have been raised in our great democracy." He confessed he had become a crusader in this war. The press became devoted to Eisenhower, in large part because he confided in journalists and trusted them to act as his partners rather than his enemies. Butcher called Eisenhower the keenest in dealing with the press I've ever seen, and I have met a lot of them, many of whom are phonies. Even the skeptical British commanders respected him and liked him more than any other American general, most of whom they openly loathed. With Marshall too valuable as chief of staff to be sent to the field command he yearned for, Roosevelt made the obvious choice to place the invasion of France in Eisenhower's hands. "Well, Ike, you're going to command Overlord," Roosevelt casually told him in the back seat of an armored Cadillac in Cairo in December 1943. It was the biggest command job of the war. Eisenhower earned it through his competent management of the troops, his disciplined strategic focus, and his scrupulously fair treatment of his resentful and frequently embittered British allies. Overlord was the turning point in Eisenhower's career. The fame and accolades he earned leading the invasion of France in 1944 and then the final assault on Germany in 1944 and 45 transformed him into the face of American victory and set spinning the wheels of fortune that would carry him to the White House precisely 9 years after being told of his new command. In planning the invasion of France, Eisenhower's skill and experience shone. Not only did he attack the operation with his usual logistical and planning talent, but he had to fight strong headwinds from none other than Churchill, who never liked the prospect of an invasion of France and thought it likely to end in disaster. By now, Eisenhower was an old hand at dealing with strong personalities. His days were full of exchanges with men such as Patton and the always difficult British combat commander General Bernard Montgomery, to say nothing of Churchill and Roosevelt. In planning for Overlord, Ike revealed a growing confidence in himself and his powers as Supreme Commander. He fought ferociously with the British and American air services, demanding that they limit assaults on Germany and instead dedicate air power to destroying rail lines into Normandy. He fought with Churchill and Brooke, who still wanted to keep pressing in Italy when he wanted troops diverted from the Mediterranean for Overlord. He fought with everyone to get more landing craft to carry as large a force as possible onto the Normandy beaches, even though this required him to delay the operation for an additional month. Tellingly, he won these battles and imposed his will on the operation. He was consumed with the challenges of directing 6,000 ships that would carry 150,000 soldiers across miles of roiling sea to be thrown against mines, tank obstacles, barbed wire, and concrete bunkers filled with thousands of well-prepared German defenders. In conference with his commanders and in public, he exuded confidence, but privately he agonized. No one who does not have to bear the specific and direct responsibility of making the final decision as to what to do, he wrote 3 days before D-Day, can understand the intensity of these burdens. He could occasionally lay down these heavy cares at the small home he occupied called Telegraph Cottage, hidden in the then remote suburbs southwest of London near Richmond Park. Here he found time to unwind, play cards with his band of devoted aides, listen to records, stroll in the garden, and rest. In those days at Telegraph Cottage among his ersatz family, he developed an amorous reliance on his pretty Irish driver and helpmeet, Kay Summersby. At a time of immense stress and anxiety, Eisenhower welcomed the attentions and ministrations of this lively young woman who gave him something else to think about than war. It is unknown if their friendship ever became sexual. The story is veiled by the fog of war. To say that they were for a time devoted to and dependent on one another is enough. The Supreme Commander did not live like a viceroy nor behave like one. He was no MacArthur. He knew at any moment a turn in the fortunes of war would bring him ignominy and defeat, and he seemed never to forget the grisly, dirty, tough business that lay ahead. Eisenhower's burdens hardly abated once the Normandy landings began in June 1944. Overlords started auspiciously, and within 3 weeks over 1 million Allied soldiers were ashore in France. But 60 divisions of well-trained and determined Germans did not break and run. It took all summer until a combination of overwhelming air, artillery, and ground assaults shattered the German defenses. By September 1944, France was cleared of Germans. Paris had been liberated, and the Allies had pushed on into Belgium. But an inexcusable delay in seizing the vital river approaches to the port of Antwerp meant that until November 1944, Allied armies could not be resupplied except by vehicles from the Normandy beachheads. Without fuel, weapons, and replacement soldiers, progress ground to a halt, and the Allied armies bogged down in a long winter war on Germany's doorstep. The war that Eisenhower hoped might end by Christmas had another 6 months left. Hitler's fateful gamble in December 1944, the counteroffensive through the thinly defended Ardennes Forest in eastern Belgium that would go down as the Battle of the Bulge, confronted Eisenhower with his last great test of the war. Hitler sent 250,000 troops into a weak American sector, hoping to divide the Allied armies, race to the sea, and retake Antwerp. For perhaps 6 days, the situation was dangerous, though not catastrophic. Eisenhower's cool handling of the crisis revealed yet again that by the end of 1944 he had learned how to manage such moments without succumbing to panic. He acted instantly and with the greatest vigor, according to his admiring chief of staff, General Walter Bedell Beetle Smith. If Eisenhower was surprised by the attack, it was because its chances of success were so slim. Hitler's westward penetration created a menacing bulge in the Allied line, but it also opened up both German flanks to counterattack, as Eisenhower anticipated. It is easier and less costly to us to kill Germans when they are attacking than when they are holed up in concrete fortifications in the Siegfried Line, he assured Butcher. The more we can kill in their present offensive, the fewer we will have to dig out pillbox by pillbox. With fighter bombers pummeling the Germans from the air and a stalwart American defense on the ground, especially it surrounded Bastogne, the bulge was contained, then destroyed. This was desperate fighting in freezing temperatures, with a terrible harvest of lives, but it was the end game. Failure in the Ardennes cost Hitler dearly. Since D-Day, the Germans had lost 400,000 casualties, while 860,000 soldiers had surrendered. If victory in Normandy had ensured the liberation of France, victory in the Ardennes ensured the defeat of the Third Reich. By January 1945, Eisenhower could say that he had broken Hitler's army in the West. The operations in March and April 1945 would deliver the coup de grace. After crossing the Rhine, Allied armies encircled the remaining German divisions in the Ruhr and snapped up 325,000 POWs. Eisenhower was brimming with confidence by now, exulting over the news from the front. Butcher said Ike acted like a football coach whose team had just won a big victory, and he couldn't help talking about the accomplishments of his players. Eisenhower wrote Swede Hazlitt that he knew on March 24th, when Allied forces crossed the Rhine, that the enemy was absolutely whipped. He had not the slightest chance from then on. By the end of April, the German army had simply disintegrated and over 1 million soldiers surrendered. On April 30th, Hitler shot himself. A week later, General Alfred Jodl, chief of the German army's general staff, appeared at Eisenhower's headquarters in Reims, France. At 2:41 a.m. on May 7th, he signed the surrender effective the next day. The war with Germany was over. In a typically unadorned telegram, Eisenhower reported to the combined chiefs of staff the result of his campaign in Europe. The mission of this Allied force was fulfilled at 02:41 local time, May 7, 1945. He and his staff retired at 5 o'clock in the morning. When Butcher looked in on Eisenhower a few hours later, he was in bed, awake, thumbing through the pages of a Western pulp fiction novel titled Cartridge Carnival. Chapter 2. Star Power. I haven't the effrontery to say I wouldn't be president. 1. Throughout three terrible years of toil, Eisenhower had given himself over wholly to his role as leader of the Allied armies. From North Africa to Italy, France, and then Germany itself, he had worked inhumanly long hours and suffered from anxiety, back and stomach problems, hypertension, and rasping respiratory troubles, much aggravated by his smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day. He had often daydreamed about retirement in letters to Mamie and his son John. Just before Christmas 1944, he wrote to Mamie, whom he had seen only once in 2 years, "I sometimes chuckle when I think of how much talking you and I will have to do when this is all over. We'll have to take a 3-month vacation on some lonely beach, and oh, lordy, lordy, let it be sunny." But if he imagined he could slip back into the quiet anonymity of his pre-war days, he was wrong. His achievements were too great for that. Even the normally restrained chief of staff of the U.S. Army, General Marshall, exulted in his success, writing a glowing personal tribute to him on VE Day. "You have completed your mission with the greatest victory in the history of warfare. You have commanded with outstanding success the most powerful military force that has ever been assembled. You have made history, great history, for the good of mankind." Within days of the German surrender, Eisenhower's headquarters filled up with congratulatory letters from heads of state, generals, friends, and citizens. Prominent among these was an invitation from the British Prime Minister to receive recognition from the people of London and to be named to the Order of Merit by King George VI. On July 12, 1945, Eisenhower traveled to London to receive the key of the city and to give an address at the bomb-shattered Gothic Guildhall, the ancient seat of London's Lord Mayor. Eisenhower worked on his Guildhall speech for 3 weeks, hoping to strike the right notes at this august occasion. He wanted to stress that the war had been won by soldiers, not generals. He wanted to acknowledge that Britons had suffered more acutely and fought longer than Americans during 6 years of war. And above all, he wanted to emphasize that Britain and America together formed the bulwark of freedom that had vanquished tyranny. His instinct at this moment of great personal triumph was to share the glory with others. The Guildhall had nearly been destroyed by the German incendiary raid of December 29, 1940, an attack that set much of the city on fire and nearly razed St. Paul's Cathedral. The building had been hastily repaired, its roof still showing temporary patches covering gaping holes. Eisenhower was carried through the city streets in a phaeton drawn by 2 horses with his wartime deputy commander, Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Tedder, at his side. The British government leaders, including Churchill, were there to welcome him. As Eisenhower mounted the rostrum in the Great Hall, the audience of dignitaries offered him a thunderous ovation. In his speech, during which he struggled to master his emotions, he demonstrated the Eisenhower touch, gracious humility, plain-spoken earnestness, and a willingness to give credit to others. "The high sense of distinction I feel upon receiving this great honor from the City of London is inescapably mingled with feelings of profound sadness," he began, striking the somber note of a battle-weary commander. Humility must always be the portion of any man who receives acclaim earned in the blood of his followers and the sacrifices of his friends. The honors a warrior may win in battle cannot hide in his memories the crosses marking the resting places of the dead, They cannot soothe the anguish of the widow or the orphan, whose husband or father will not return. It is impossible to imagine Patton or MacArthur sounding so mournful in this moment of high honor, or deflecting the proffered acclaim under the hallowed memory of fallen soldiers. Eisenhower repaid the compliment London gave him by recalling the city's tragic passage through the war. He praised the residents for their courage as they endured Hitler's air attacks at a time when Americans were still oblivious to the great sacrifices the British were making. He recalled the shock of the green American soldiers who arrived in Britain and saw firsthand what war had done to this proud and defiant people. And he emphasized the common commitment of America and Britain to freedom. In a flourish that linked his humble hometown to the majestic British capital, he declared, "To preserve his freedom of worship, his equality before the law, his liberty to speak and act as he sees fit, subject only to the provision that we trespass not upon similar rights of others, the Londoner will fight, so will the citizen of Abilene." The speech even melted the icy heart of one of Eisenhower's most ferocious critics, Field Marshal Lord Allenbrooke, as he was now, who confided in his diary, "Ike made a wonderful speech, and impressed all hearers in the Guildhall, including the cabinet. I had never realized that Ike was as big a man until I heard his performance today." The warm and heartfelt adoration of London paled in comparison to the reception he received upon his return to the United States. On June 19th, more than 4 million New Yorkers welcomed Eisenhower during a long open-car journey through the streets of the city. All the way down Fifth Avenue, then all the way up Broadway, an avalanche of ticker tape and confetti rained down on the beaming general. It was at the time the largest parade crowd in the city's history. Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia proclaimed June 19th Eisenhower Day and declared a holiday for city employees, urging New Yorkers to hang flags and give the general a full-throated welcome. In his address at City Hall, Eisenhower paid tribute to the soldiers still in the battlefields of Asia, as well as the productive forces on the home front that had made victory in Europe possible. He insisted, "There is no greater pacifist than the regular officer. Any man who is forced to turn his attention to the horrors of the battlefield, to the grotesque shapes that are left there for the burying squad, he doesn't want war. He never wants it." And he called for a great effort to return the world to peace. "As I see it, peace is an absolute necessity to this world. Americans should be strong, but we should be tolerant. We should be ready to defend our rights, but we should be considerate and recognize the rights of the other man." He had begun his transition from soldier to statesman. At this moment of triumph, Eisenhower was 55 years old, and the world's best known and most respected soldier. He embodied America's victory over fascism and Nazism. He possessed extraordinary political gifts and had been able to find compromise and consensus among headstrong Allied leaders where rivalry and bickering predominated. Raised in the solitude of the Kansas Plains, he now knew every corner of the globe and had worked intimately with great men of state. He remained comfortable in his own skin, a characteristic that made him a natural communicator with the press, with his fellow military commanders, and especially with the soldiers he sent into battle, whose company he loved. For a man of such skills and abilities, the future was his for the asking. President Truman understood this. A practiced politician, he had a nose for winners. In mid-July, Truman traveled to Europe to meet with Churchill and Premier Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union at the great post-war conference in Potsdam, Germany. By this time, Eisenhower had returned to Europe in his role as commander of the military occupation of the defeated nation, and he welcomed Truman to Germany. The two had met only a few times before, though the president obviously had a high opinion of America's foremost soldier. Truman had mused in his diary the previous month about the varying qualities of U.S. generals. "Don't see how a country can produce such men as Robert E. Lee, John J. Pershing, Eisenhower and Bradley, and at the same time produce Custers, Pattons, and MacArthurs." In Berlin, Truman found a moment to talk politics with Eisenhower. One day, Eisenhower later recalled. When the president was riding with General Bradley and me, he fell to discussing the future of some of our war leaders. Eisenhower told Truman he hoped to retire soon. I shall never forget the president's answer. Now in the car, he suddenly turned toward me and said, "General, there is nothing that you may want that I won't try to help you get. That definitely and specifically includes the presidency in 1948. It was a striking thing for Truman to say. It may have been meant as a gesture of flattery. Perhaps Truman was still feeling somewhat out of his depth in the new job. He'd been president for only 3 months. Perhaps he wanted to ingratiate himself with a man who was far better known worldwide and far more popular in America than he was. But it might also be that Truman perceived in Eisenhower what the general did not yet perceive in himself. Star power. His countrymen now revered him. World leaders everywhere knew and trusted him, and the end of hostilities with Germany, far from bringing an end to his career, would open up new vistas for the soldier of democracy. Eisenhower was suddenly struck in his emotional vitals by this astounding proposition, and once the shock had passed, he tried to laugh it off. This was the position he adopted whenever the question of a political career came up. He wanted to retire, he said. Failing that, he thought he might run a small college, write his memoirs, and do some public speaking. Nothing could be so distasteful to me as to engage in political activity of any kind, he wrote one eager supporter in August 1945. His own desire, as he told Marshall that same month, was to find a remotely situated cottage in which to hide, and to let someone else have both the headaches and the headlines. 2. No such luck. The job he now faced as governor of occupied Germany presented him with extraordinary troubles. For the defeated Reich lay prostrate, its cities ruined and clogged with rubble and refugees. The country is devastated, Eisenhower wrote Mamie. Whole cities are obliterated, and the German population, to say nothing of millions of former slave laborers, is largely homeless. The country faced acute shortages of food and coal for heating and cooking, and millions of war-weary refugees swarmed across the charred landscape. It is a bleak picture, he wrote. In my wildest nightmares, I never visualized some of the things now thrown at me. As he tried to navigate these complexities, he was extremely fortunate in having one of the ablest military administrators in the army as his deputy, Lieutenant General Lucius D. Clay, who bore on his shoulders much of the daily work of running the occupation zone. Clay, the son of a U.S. senator from Georgia and a West Point graduate, had known Eisenhower since they served together in the Philippines. An engineer, Clay had overseen the construction of hundreds of airfields in North America during the war, and in 1944 served alongside Eisenhower again in Normandy, winning a Bronze Star for his heroic efforts in getting the Cherbourg Harbor up and running after the Germans had mined it. Eisenhower and Clay set up shop in the huge office complex of the chemical giant IG Farben, the firm that had manufactured the poison gas used to asphyxiate Jews in Hitler's extermination camps. Ike hated the job. He came in for sharp criticism from the press for the long delays in getting the troops home, for failing to arrest all the top Nazis, for lapses in delivering food, clothing, coal, and other supplies. Fighting the Germans seemed easier than trying to govern them. He was, as his son John noted, a lonely man, let down after the excitement of the war. Eisenhower did his best to develop a good working relationship with Marshal Georgi Zhukov, the commander of the Soviet zone of occupation in Germany. If they could cooperate inside the Allied Control Council, which was set up in Berlin and acted as the four-power joint headquarters for the running of the occupation, then all the subsequent problems would resolve themselves much more easily. Berlin, we were convinced, was an experimental laboratory for the development of international accord, Eisenhower wrote. Success in Berlin could be translated into a world partnership with the USSR. He liked Zhukov, a true soldier and not a Communist Party hack, and he felt he understood the Soviet outlook. They had sacrificed more than any other nation to defeat Hitler's armies, and wanted to be sure the job of breaking Germany was done once and for all. All that was needed was a friendly acceptance of each other as individuals, striving peacefully to attain a common understanding. It was a characteristically optimistic, even naive view of world affairs. To cultivate the friendship, he agreed to visit Moscow in August. It was an eye-opening trip. "When we flew into Russia in 1945, he recalled, "I did not see a house standing between the western borders of the country and the area around Moscow, a distance of over 500 miles. Arriving on August 12th from Berlin in the company of Zhukov, as well as his son John, Eisenhower was welcomed by an honor guard at the airport and the American ambassador Avril Harriman. According to John, the people of Moscow looked very shabby, and the houses were dingy, crowded, and miserable-looking. But the following day, in the presence of the sinister warlord Stalin, Eisenhower observed the astonishing spectacle of the physical culture parade in Red Square. Thousands upon thousands of athletes, dancers, musicians, acrobats, and members of youth organizations, all resplendent in gleaming native costumes, marched or danced jubilantly past the reviewing stand where the Soviet leadership stood. Early in the proceedings, Eisenhower received an invitation from Stalin to join the Generalissimo on Lenin's tomb, an extraordinary honor for a foreigner. Stalin beamed as the endless parade unfolded over the course of 5 hours. "This develops war spirit," he remarked. "Your country ought to do more of this." And then, as an afterthought, he added coldly, "We will never allow Germany to do this." The visit lasted 3 days, during which Eisenhower toured the Moscow subway, a collective farm, a fighter aircraft factory, and the Kremlin itself. On August 13th, Stalin hosted a banquet at the Kremlin. John recalled, "All the Soviet officers wore white tunics, and this, combined with the glistening tablecloth and gigantic crystal chandeliers, gave an aura of brilliance that I have never seen elsewhere." At the American embassy the next night, in an atmosphere of growing cordiality, American and Soviet generals drank rivers of vodka and champagne, locking arms and breaking into a hearty chorus of "Song of the Volga Boatman." The evening was topped off when Ambassador Harriman arrived with joyful news. The Japanese had surrendered. The war was truly over. It is not without reason that Eisenhower could look back at this moment and conclude, "The late summer and early autumn of 1945 represents the peak of post-war cordiality and cooperation that we were ever able to achieve with the Soviet officials." Soon after his return to Berlin, Eisenhower received a letter from General Marshall. The chief of staff wrote that he planned to retire, and that he had urged Truman to appoint Eisenhower as his successor. Eisenhower had suspected this was coming and dreaded it. To be sure, this was the top job in the American military, and he told Marshall that he was willing to attempt anything that my superiors may direct. But he knew it was going to be a terribly hard assignment, overseeing the dismantling of the huge military apparatus that the United States had assembled at such great cost. Nor did he wish to go back to Washington. "It all leaves me very cold," he wrote Mamie. "If the president wants me to take the job at any given time, it is, of course, my duty to do so. But you are certainly in no doubt as to what the effect on me will be. That city really bears down on me." Still, staying in Germany was no better. He had been in Europe for over 3 years, missed his wife terribly, and was ready to go home. In November 1945, while on a visit to the States to testify before Congress and speak at the American Legion Conference, he fell ill with pneumonia and had to be hospitalized for 2 weeks at the Greenbrier Hotel, which had been converted during the war to an Army rest facility in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. When he emerged at the end of the month, rested and healed, he went directly to work in Washington as Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army. "No personal enthusiasm marked my promotion to Chief of Staff," Ike later admitted. Almost immediately, Eisenhower faced trouble. In January 1946, a serious crisis broke out over the demobilization of U.S. soldiers. They wanted to get home fast, but getting 8 million soldiers back to the United States would take some time. Congress, under siege by voters and Bring Daddy Home clubs that had sprouted up across the country, was pressing the Army to move faster. By the end of 1945, 4 million soldiers had already been discharged. The aim was to get another 2 million home by June 30th. But on January 4th, 1946, the Army disclosed a new policy. In order to maintain occupation troops overseas sufficient to keep order, demobilization would have to be slowed. Within days, thousands of GIs in Manila, Seoul, Guam, Hawaii, Le Havre, and Paris staged loud protests, marching with picket signs reading, "Bring the GIs home," and "No boats, no votes." The commander of the U.S. 8th Army in Yokohama declared a general breakdown in morale and discipline. In Frankfurt, a loud group of soldiers marched to the doors of the American military headquarters and were met by a barricade of military police, bayonets fixed. The New York Times called it the worst administrative and morale crisis that the Army has faced. Eisenhower moved decisively to grapple with the problem. He delivered detailed and comprehensive testimony to a joint session of Congress on January 15th, then issued a radio broadcast explaining his plans. He promised that all 3 million soldiers eligible for discharge would be out of uniform by the 1st of July. But he reminded Congress and the country that the Army still had a job to do in occupied lands and needed manpower to do it. As long as the policy of the government was to help stabilize the post-war world, the United States would need to keep some soldiers overseas. Those who had seen combat would have priority for returning home, while those newly entering the Army through the Selective Service System would now have to do their part. Eisenhower seemed to have doused the flames of the crisis, but in a private letter to MacArthur he seethed, "No amount of persuasive argument, based on logic, reason, and national duty, has had material effect in combating hysteria generated by pressure groups." This was to become a common refrain as he labored through his new assignment at the Pentagon. While Americans were ready to be done with the war, Eisenhower preached a sermon of preparedness. He did not want to dismantle the armed forces so completely as to leave America unprepared, as it had been on the eve of World War II. He called for the continuation of the draft into peacetime and strongly supported Truman's proposal, made in October 1945, for some kind of mandatory military service for all 18-year-old males. "If we are to retain any semblance of military power," he wrote to an old wartime colleague, the American financier Bernard Baruch, "we can only do so by establishing a ready reserve of trained manpower to support our regular military establishments." But Congress refused to consider it. The war was over and the public's appetite for sacrifice had waned. Ike found it no easier to impose order over the services. His effort to unify the command of the three branches in hopes of limiting inter-service rivalries, streamlining command decisions, and reducing cost was opposed strongly by the Navy, and all of his appeals to common effort and selflessness did little to overcome their ingrained mutual suspicions. Eisenhower discovered that the unrivaled power and influence he exercised during the war had shrunk. He was now just another bureaucrat, going to Congress hat in hand. And Congress was in no mood to spend on military appropriations. "Too often," he wrote, "my recommendations were ignored." It was a cruel fate. The massive fighting force Eisenhower had led in wartime withered away on his watch. Though Eisenhower usually refrained from criticism of political leaders, his exasperation occasionally spilled out into public. In a speech he delivered in April 1946 to the American Newspaper Publishers Association, he decried an American tendency to ignore, in time of peace, the basic military problems of the country. Following a 2-week tour of military installations across the United States, he concluded that because of the pell-mell demobilization, it would take a year of hard work just to get the U.S. military back to its 1940 state of readiness. A low threshold, indeed. In the shadow of the most costly conflict of all time, he boldly declared, the country was ignoring the chief lesson of the war, that peace can be assured only through military strength.